time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. I'd like to say it's a beautiful day out there today, but that would not be true. It's a little drizzly and quite dark out there today, but that's okay. We'll brighten it up for you. Coming up on the program in just a moment here, we're going to kick off our discussion with former Governor Jim Douglas. We're going to talk about his autobiography, The Vermont Way. If you want to see him in person, he's going to be right down the street at Bridgeside Books coming up at 10 o'clock, right after... Well, maybe, I don't know, maybe it'll be like
10 o'clock.
5 after or 10 after or something, depending on how many great questions all of you folks have out there. And you can reach us this morning on the program at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. Coming up next hour, we're going to tell you about the Button Up program, and there's a contest, so there's opportunities for you in that one. Again, our number's on the program, 244-1777, and our toll-free line's 877-291-8255. Quick note, coming up on the program tomorrow, I'll be down at the Tunbridge World's Fair. We're going to have a Lieutenant Governor's Debate Saturday special edition of the program. We're going to have a governor's debate.
I'm going to miss that. Sorry.
How come? Not available?
Because I can.
Because you're not running.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you can actually listen, and maybe you could give me a question. So, what would be the question that you would ask the gubernatorial candidates in 2014? What's the critical question?
Jobs and demographics. I think the state is still facing some real challenges as we seek to provide opportunities for the people of Vermont. Our workforce has shrunk. Our population is static. It's aging. We are losing our kids still. So I think that continues to be the challenge that we've been facing for some time.
Maybe you can do something about jobs, but what do you do about the tide of demographics?
Well, we keep our young people here by making an affordable place to live, and that's been, I think, the most important objective.
This is September 11th. Where were you September 11th, 2001?
In Santa Fe, New Mexico. I was president of the National Association of State Treasurers. We were having our annual meeting there. And as you've been discussing on the air this morning, it's a defining event in our time, and we'll always remember where we were and what we did at that point. Contrary to my practice, hadn't turned the TV on in the hotel room. I had some phone calls to make back to Vermont, and so I went downstairs to the meeting, and of course it's a couple hours behind East Coast time, and the executive director of the association asked, well, what should we do? And to which I replied, what do you mean?
Mm-hmm.
We have an agenda. No, because of what happened back east. What happened back east? So I was clueless until she told me about it, and then the big question was, what to do? Do we cancel the whole event? And I think, as you've been discussing on the air, its significance wasn't immediately apparent to everybody. So we decided to continue on a sort of muted basis, but understood that people may not want to attend all the meetings. And there were a couple of interesting memories from that day. One is the New York State Treasurer, George Gasser, who is a retired military guy, cool, calm, collected, I thought was going to lose it because he had 400 employees in one of the World Trade Towers, and there he was helpless, just watching it on TV. Ultimately, he lost only 40, but tragedy for his office. And then, interestingly, 5 years later, Mark, it became an issue in the California gubernatorial campaign. My staff got a call from Governor Schwarzenegger's staff saying, hey, we got a really good hit on the opponent, who was the state treasurer of California. He was at that annual meeting in Santa Fe, and he didn't immediately come home to California because of the tragedy. And I said, well, nobody could go anywhere.
Right.
What was he going to do, thumb? So I said,
a little shorter thumb than you would have had, but still.
I said, I don't think that's a good hit, and I don't think Arnold used it.
The president gave a speech last night talking about this Islamic threat. Did you see it by any chance?
I did not. I was getting well-rested for this program, Mark.
You described Obama as somebody who came into office with critical weaknesses. What did you mean by that?
Lack of experience, basically. He'd been a state senator in Illinois for a couple of years, really 2 years in the U.S. Senate before he began to run. No executive experience at all. I guess I have a predisposition toward governors serving in the White House because it's the only comparable responsibility. So I thought he came in with a lot of goodwill. He's a smart guy, very cerebral, but not any experience to become the leader of the free world.
Has he overcome those critical weaknesses?
Well, I think his biggest shortcoming is his unwillingness or inability to continue to reach out across the aisle. I thought he was doing very well initially. As you know, I was the first governor to have a one-on-one meeting with him just a week and a half after he took office. And I thought, was reaching out pretty well early on. But he's not a schmoozer. He's not a Bill Clinton. He needs to spend more time with legislative leaders, congressional leaders, and try to build the coalitions that are important to his agenda. And that's just not his strong suit. And I think we've seen that.
Talking with former Governor Jim Douglas, his book is called The Vermont Way, A Republican Governor Leads America's Most Liberal State. Let's go to the phones. We go to Berrytown. Lawrence, good morning.
Mark Johnson and the governor of the great state of Vermont, Lawrence Jost, kind of losing his breath because he's out taking a six-mile walk, which he does every day, listening to the Mark Johnson show. I spent the past weekend with our mutual friend Larry Myatt up in Lake Carmi, and you were very gracious in your autograph and the copy of the book you bought. But what's baffled my mind about you, Governor, since the day I met you is, how do you remember my name and the names of everybody else everywhere you go?
All right. Thanks, Lawrence.
Well, I think the legend may be a little greater than the reality, Lawrence, but thanks for the call. And I try to I try to focus on that. I pledged to myself early on not to be one of those politicians who just says hi, and people go through the line and you don't remember anybody, but to try to recall something about people, to look them in the eye, to try to develop a context, and then perhaps I might remember them again. Doesn't always work. Sometimes I see someone totally out of context at the other end of the state from where he or she lives, and it kind of throws me for a loop. I've tried to treat every Vermonter as the important person that he or she is.
I thought there were a remarkable number of times in your book where you didn't use names, where you wouldn't identify who somebody was. Why did you do that?
Well, I didn't think it was important, and I understand what you're talking about, Mark. I did throw a few sharp elbows in there because I thought it was important for Vermonters to know the truth as I see it and what my experiences were in office. But sometimes I didn't feel that it was essential to identify the individual, but rather just the context or the office.
Okay. I mean, for example, you talked about some Supreme Court justices or nominees who were qualified at one point and then not qualified. I mean, why not just name that?
Well, that specifically is confidential when they apply, and by law, it's not disclosed.
Okay. Let me give another example. Media people, for example, there's a particular columnist who used to write for 7 days, Peter Frain. Why not name him? What's the point of that?
I don't know if it's fair to name someone who isn't with us to respond, so I just kept that generic too.
Okay, why didn't you name his, as you called him, his replacement, Shay Totten, who is still with us?
Well, I just chose not to.
Why? Why would you do that?
I don't know. Just the way my pen worked when I, or pixels worked when I put this together.
Okay. There's another point in the book where you talk about when you would go to towns and there were lawmakers there that were not with you as well. Talk about how you would deal with that when there would be a friendly person and not a friendly person in the audience.
Well, I have to admit that's not an original idea. I was chatting with some gubernatorial colleagues about how to handle that. But at least in a few cases, I can remember saying, well, it's wonderful to see Senator so-and-so here. You know, he's the finest lawmaker since Daniel Webster, and it's great to have him in our midst. He's been responsible for just about every major legislation we've seen in Vermont over the last few years, and we just wouldn't be the wonderful place to live without him. Oh, and I see Representative so-and-so here, too.
What were you trying to accomplish with that? I honestly, when I read it, it sounded a little petty.
Well, I guess the alternative is to not recognize them at all. But I just feel that I'm not going to be dishonest. And I'm not going to say, here's Representative so-and-so who is a great guy, when I don't believe that. So that's how I handled it.
We're talking this morning with former Governor Jim Douglas. His book is The Vermont Way. You can reach us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. People do different things with autobiographies in terms of what they're trying to accomplish. What were you trying to accomplish with this book?
Well, a couple of objectives, really. One is a lot of people asked me over the course of my career in public life to write something. They thought I might have some interesting observations, and I think they're right. I had the extraordinary privilege, Mark, of serving Vermont for 3.5 decades. It was a time of great change politically in our state, and I thought I could reduce my experiences to writing and perhaps offer some perspectives, some stories, maybe some lessons learned along the way. And finally, it is, as the subtitle suggests, somewhat oxymoronic that a Republican continues to succeed in such a deep blue state. In fact, the first time I met the President-elect Obama after the 08 election, that's what he asked me. How'd you win up there?
And you said you rode his coattails.
That's exactly what I told him, right. So I thought there might be an interesting story about that contrast and how I did it.
But I didn't really feel as though I totally grasped what your point was on that. So what was the insight that I was supposed to have gotten on that in terms of how you were able to be successful in such a liberal state?
Well, two answers to that, I guess. First, the caller, Lawrence, suggested one of them, which is to get around a lot. I was made fun of, as you know, by some people in the press and political opponents for the time I spent getting around the state, clipping ribbons or attending various events. I think it's fair to say my successor has been quite proficient at that, too. But getting around, spending an awful lot of time meeting the people of Vermont, I think was one key, because when people would hear in the press or read in the press that I've done something awful, the campaign commercial or whatever, having met me, they could see that I didn't have horns and was probably a pretty good guy. And secondly, the principal title of the book, Vermont is a place where people want balance, centrism, want practicality. They don't want extremism one way or the other. And that's what I sought to accomplish. The title meant the balance between our economic growth and environmental conservation, but it became more than that. It became a culture of civility in public discourse, in political discussions. And I think that's important in these very challenging times.
In terms of getting around the state, I didn't realize the extent to which you almost had this down to a science. You write about how Tim Hayward, your chief of staff, had set up this computer program. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, I wanted to be sure that I didn't fall into the trap of spending most of my time where it was convenient. I live in Middlebury. The state's population center is, of course, Chittenden County. And then I worked in Washington County. And it would be easy to spend an awful lot of time in that triangle, but I felt that it was important to be fair to all the parts of Vermont, that they should see me proportional to their size. And so Tim developed a program that calculated the percentage of the state's population in each county and the number of times I visited that county in a particular week or month. And when I got low on a particular area, which was pretty easy, and the far north or far south, and I would find ways to rebalance.
Mm-hmm. Not just go where you're needed.
Well, I felt it was important to make sure that everybody got a proportional amount of my time. And I think every part of the state has needs of various kinds. Obviously, a crisis would interrupt a schedule if I had planned to go somewhere. But there are people in every part of Vermont who have the right to have some time with the chief executive to express to him or her their hopes and dreams and aspirations. And I wanted to make sure they had the chance.
Let's go to Berlin. Tom, good morning. You're on the air with former Governor Jim Douglas.
Yeah, good morning. Well, I was going to say that for quite a few years, we used to have the contract for the State House cafeteria, and Mr. Douglas and then on the same thing, Lola Aiken, were some of the people that always, you know, took the time to say hi to everybody and stop in and know people's names as usual, and they were both great at that. And my question is, knowing that you were pretty much assured you could win another election, and the fact you obviously loved the job, why did you decide to not do it? And I'll just listen.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Well, there are a couple of answers to that, Tom. Thanks for your great work through the years, too. I really appreciated that. You kept me fed and caffeinated, for which I'm very grateful. In Vermont, I think the default is to keep running. We have a short term. We have no term limits. It's easy to say, oh, all right, the numbers look pretty good. Yeah, I'll do it again. But I said to my staff, you know, I want to be as energetic on my last day in office as on my first. And I'm nearly a decade older, and I'm not sure I can make that commitment. Having gone to the 8th annual meeting of the Blank Association, I began to think maybe somebody else should have that privilege. So energy level is one consideration. And secondly, it was a time in my life and my family's life when it just seemed like the right time to move on. At that point, Dorothy and I had four aging parents, two of whom have since died. We were new grandparents. It just seemed like it was a good opportunity for us to move on to a new phase because, as we've been discussing, I took it very seriously. I was all in. Mark, I think I wrote to someone, asked Dorothy, on average, how many nights a week is he home for dinner? And her response was, on average, about zero. So I just didn't feel that I wanted to continue to make that commitment. And finally, from a purely political and legacy standpoint, there's an old saying that you want to leave the party while folks are having a good time. And I wanted to leave when I didn't have to, when the poll numbers suggested, as you did, Tom, that I could likely win another term, but to go out on a high note. And all those considerations just seemed to coincide and seemed to me like a good time to pass the baton.
Which begs the obvious question, are you totally done with electoral politics?
Well, I think so, except for perhaps town moderator in Middlebury. I might seek that again.
Okay. Anything else?
I don't have any plans to. I heard that question posed to Mitt Romney the other day, and he said, well, I'm 99% sure I'm not going to, but we don't want a recording of this show, Mark, to be thrown back at me if for some reason unforeseen circumstances arise and I should change my mind, but I'm pretty sure.
You talked about one of the reasons when you ran initially, Tim Hayward had you write down the reasons why you would run, and one of them you said is that Vermont was going through a period of divisiveness. What did you do in your 8 years of office to lessen that divisiveness in Vermont?
Well, part of it's tone. I did my best to not raise my voice, not to be bombastic, but to be even-keeled and to listen to other people's ideas, to respect them. There are a lot of tough issues that we confronted, as you know, during that time, and people have strongly held views, but I respect them all, and it's important to be inclusive and have everybody at the table. I had a lot of meetings with individuals and groups and organizations with whom I disagreed, but I think it was important to have that access and that discussion. And I think that's critical in a state like ours. So I think communication with the people of Vermont was a critical part of that objective. I won't tell you that there weren't occasional times when people were a little excited about some things. But on balance, I think we can be proud of our level of discourse. And that's to our credit.
Let's go to Middlebury. Pat, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
Just great.
Thank you. Good. Thank you very much, Governor Douglas. I've been wanting to say that for a long time. You and I have worked side by side before, painting the field at the high school, getting that up and ready for the boys. I just want to let you know that what you did while you were in office inspired a bunch of us a lot of us in the Addison County Firefighter Association, just for the simple reason is I can remember when I belonged, I've belonged to two different organizations in Addison County, one in New Haven and back in Millbury now for the last 31 years as a volunteer. But when I was in New Haven, we had a, I won't say it a disaster, but a strong storm come through, flooded a bunch of roads, got a bunch of stuff, and we were working, you know, night and day, day and night, working on 2 and 3 hours of sleep that night, trying to keep this town going. And one morning we're standing outside the fire station at, I wasn't going to say around 5 o'clock in the morning, trying to get everybody up and running and getting going. And we turn around and here comes Governor Douglas. Steps up, talks to all of us. You know, I don't think people realize what kind of a spring in your step you get after, you know, you working that many hours, you know, because you want to. It's not because you need to, but because you want to help out your community. And you turn around and here comes the governor at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I didn't sleep a lot. There's an old saying that you can sleep when you're dead. I wasn't very good at vacations either, something that's been noted more recently as well. But I took that seriously, to get around and see Vermonters in their places of work and volunteer situations, and to understand what was going on around our state. And it wasn't unusual for me to pop into a Red Cross shelter at night, for example, in an area that's suffered a flood or a power outage, or, of course, to greet our soldiers and airmen coming back from service in the Middle East and at strange hours of the night. But I felt it was important. I thought, given what they've done, given what people like you, Pat, do on a volunteer basis day in and day out, the least I can do is show up and say thanks.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. You right when you won the governor's race back in 2002, you talk about it was a close, you know, it was a relatively close race. There was this poll that came out ahead of time that was very dubious, the Burlington Free Press poll having you down by 10 points. So you write here, after this entire race is done here, this last part here, you say, after appearing with Doug Racine at a State House press conference and accepting a congratulatory phone call from President Bush, I strode hand-in-hand with Dorothy down the front steps of the Capitol. It was a cold and rainy day, but as I anticipated continuing to serve Vermont, I foresaw instead days of sunshine and opportunity. How did you feel at that point? What was that like as an accomplishment in your life?
Well, a very significant one, of course, although I remember something Dick Snelling said in 1976 when he gave his farewell speech to the House as he embarked upon his first successful gubernatorial campaign. And he said, you know, whatever happens in the future, the most exciting time of my life will be serving in this chamber. And I thought at the time, really? And as I reflect on it now, Mark, I have to tell you that the most exciting election of my life was 1972, the first time that people actually voted for me, conferred upon me the responsibility of serving them in a public capacity. And so I think that, to be honest, is the moment that was the most exciting in electoral politics. 02 was obviously a tremendous accomplishment. I was quite tired, having been up most of the night. And there's an old saying that if you care who wins on election night, you haven't worked hard enough. So it had been a very exhausting final push. But I also realized that we had a lot of work to do, and my staff weren't very happy when I called a staff meeting for 9 o'clock that morning. I cut them a little slack, but we had to get going. So I was pleased. I was happy. It was a great, great moment personally for me, but I realized that I had to roll up my sleeves.
As a reader, I felt like I missed something there.
Well,
some insight, some... you know, this is a significant accomplishment in your life, and I wanted to know more.
Well, we have to wait for the sequel, I guess.
Okay. Is there going to be a second book where we get a lot of reflection and insight or something?
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to do that, having been through this process, but I'm not sure what to say. I was obviously pleased and happy, tired, anticipating a great opportunity to serve the state. I'm not a guy who talks more than I need to.
Mm-hmm. George W. Bush talked about that, about he wasn't really a guy who engaged in a lot of self-reflection. Or do you feel you're sort of the same kind of person?
Well, perhaps so. It's not easy to talk and write about yourself. I was talking with a...
But that's the point of an autobiography.
Well, it is. But I was talking with a colleague of yours who covered the news for a long time and then wrote a memoir, and he said that was a very difficult thing to do, a very difficult transition, a different perspective. I'm not comfortable talking about myself either, but you're right. That is the point, maybe I could have said more in a couple of areas, but I think the book's long enough.
There was another area, though, too. The 92 race with Leahy. I mean, that was the only political race you lost, right?
Except for a speaker's race, but yeah.
That's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote about that race, and I guess I want to even know now, what did you learn from that experience of losing? What did you learn from losing?
Well, I didn't have high expectations. I understood the challenge I was undertaking, but I felt it was the right thing to do. And I still feel very strongly about the impact of campaign contributions on our political system. I ran then first because I felt there was an anti-incumbent wave that actually peaked 2 years later. And so I certainly believed I had an opportunity. But because the senator was getting 96% of his money from outside Vermont, and I thought, gosh, whom is he representing? And I realized I tied my hands by saying that I would take 100% of mine from only Vermonters, but I felt it was the right thing to do. So I guess what I learned from that is that you don't always win, but you have to be able to hold your head high and look in the mirror and feel good about the race you ran, and I did.
Did you learn anything that helped you in future races?
Well, I'm not sure. I'd run a number of races already by that time. I guess I learned that I could play in the big leagues, that although he was a veteran senator at that point, 18 years, I could still debate him on those few occasions when he was willing to and hold my own. So perhaps it showed me that if I decided, and I had no clue at that point, to take on another major race, I'd feel comfortable doing that.
We're going to take a short commercial break. We'll come back, continue our discussion. We've been talking this morning with former Governor Jim Douglas. His book is The Vermont Way, A Republican Governor Leads America's Most Liberal State. He'll be over at Bridgeside Books coming up in about a half an hour. We'll take a quick break back after this.
Tired of grocery shopping at huge supermarkets with no personality? This is Tom Mihuron, and I invite you to shop our well-stocked, right-sized family market in Waitsfield. Custom-cut meats, fresh seafood and produce, gourmet cheeses, regular and organic groceries, and over 1,000 wines. Come and see Jeff and Bill in the meat department, Tana and produce, Gary in seafood, Nate in the deli, or Nancy and Liz in our incredible wine department. Family-run for over 70 years. Mihuron Supermarket, Village Square Shopping Center in Waitsfield.
Hi, this is Rich Harvey from Montpelier Pharmacy and Waterbury Pharmacy. The leaves are turning and the nights are cooler. For me, this means that I need to plan for the flu season. Although the flu season doesn't usually peak in Vermont until January, everyone should be thinking of getting a flu shot. The flu affects everyone, but hits people with chronic medical conditions and the young and old hardest. More than 30,000 people will die from the flu this year. The flu shot is very safe. Because it's not a live vaccine, you can't get the flu from the flu shot. We'll be offering preservative-free flu shots regularly from October through January. Most insurances cover the flu shot. If you're a business owner and want to protect your employees, give us a call and we'll send over a team to vaccinate your employees and we'll bill you later. So protect yourself, your family, and your employees and get a flu shot. Give us a call with any questions. Montpelier Pharmacy, 223-4633. Waterbury Pharmacy, 244-7701. Locally owned and independent. Thank you.
I continue our discussion. We've been talking this morning with former Vermont Governor Jim Douglas. His book is The Vermont Way. Let's head to Burlington. Dale, how you doing this morning?
Good morning. Good morning, Governor. Good morning, Mark. Just wanted to call and thank the governor for his outstanding service through all the years and to say that he is the person that I've voted for the most in my 37 years of voting in Vermont. And I really respect the job that he did. And I will close by saying that maybe the reason that governor has trouble writing about himself is because he's a very honest man, as compared to so many other of our politicians that are pretty good at writing fiction. So.
Wow. Okay. All right. Thanks, Dale.
Thank you, Governor.
Thanks, Dale.
So you didn't need a ghostwriter or anything. Anybody help you write this?
No. It's all mine.
Okay. All mine. For better or for worse, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's the title of one of the chapters, by the way.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about a couple of the sharp elbows, if we could, here for a moment here. So where do you think the sharp elbows were?
Oh, I'll respond to your questions, Mark.
Well, you said you delivered some sharp elbows. What do you think was the sharpest of the elbows you delivered?
Well, I don't know that there's a particularly sharp one, but I didn't feel that I could talk about my time in office without mentioning the experience with legislative leaders, and so I talk about some of them, I obviously did use some names.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about the current governor here. You say that he's somebody who you have no clue what really motivates him. Can you give me an example or two of what led you to say that?
Well, it's a difficult topic because he happened to succeed me. I took great pains to make it clear that I talked about legislative leaders with whom I worked. Coincidentally, one went on to the governorship, but that's not the topic of my discussion. But I think I talked publicly at the time about a press conference I had with then Senate Leader Shumlin and Speaker Symington, where he said famously, there's no new capacity for taxes in the state. And literally, within hours, there were five Senate committees working on tax increases, and I didn't understand that. So I just found it challenging.
Mm-hmm. You also suggest or say that he would change his tune on different occasions depending on what you were talking about. Give me an example of that when that happened.
Well, I guess that's one that I just told you about. To stand there and say we're not going to raise taxes and then to have his committees go off and do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to figure out what was going on.
Any other examples that stood out?
Not coming to mind right now.
Okay. So one example is what would suggest that he changes his mind frequently on something? I mean, come on, Jim.
Well, I'm sure there are plenty of others, but this is a tough territory because we take a pledge, as you know, Mark, not to talk about the person who holds the gubernatorial office now, and I found that very tricky, but I also felt that Vermonters deserved some straight talk on this topic, and so I offered some.
Okay. Let me ask you about a current Supreme Court justice. You talk about the gay marriage bill, and you talk about Peter Shumlin. The Senate leader who succeeded me in the governorship was a strong proponent of the measure and was rewarded in his campaign by endorsements from gay marriage activists. Since he was nominated by a scant 200 votes in the Democratic primary, their support may well have provided the margin of victory. He later reciprocated by appointing one of the leading lobbyists of the movement to the Vermont Supreme Court. What are you suggesting by reciprocated?
Well, with all due respect to the justice, I think it's hard for most Vermonters to believe that she would have risen to the top of the pack but for her leadership on that issue.
So you think she was appointed because she was the lead attorney on the gay marriage issue?
She obviously became well-known because of that, and who knows?
You feel that's a fair comment to make? I mean, what do you base that on? Just a gut assumption, or what do you base that on?
Well, I talk in another chapter about the judicial nominating process and my lack of satisfaction with that whole enterprise. It's unfortunately more political than most people think. Majority of the nominating board are politicians, and although it's better than electing judges, as a lot of other states do, I'm not sure we're exactly where we ought to be in terms of a completely objective process. So I think that's a fair assessment.
It is a process, though. You write that it's a lot better than it was before. I mean, you write about mm-hmm. what it was earlier, and it was not that long ago that what happened? How were judges?
The Superior and Supreme Court judges were chosen by the legislature, and I was in the legislature during one election of a Supreme Court justice that led me to strongly support the change to the current process. It was unseemly, to be honest. I remember the wife of one of the candidates for a Supreme Court slot working the halls of the State House, talking unfavorably about the other judge. And I thought, gosh, this really isn't a way to choose people who are the Supreme Court of our state. So what we have now is better than that, but I think it's not quite good enough.
What? Now, there's another example. Why didn't you name who that was? I wanted to know who that was.
Well, I don't think it's important. They're both dead now.
Okay. So we're not. You had a rule. You don't name dead people or people that you don't like who are alive. Is that what was the rationale of who you would name?
Well, I don't know that there's a rational rationale, but that's just the way I chose to handle it in some cases.
You talk about the Conservation Law Foundation. Don't have any hesitation naming them. And you talk about them. This is an organization that has opposed efforts, including the Circumferential Highway and also some Walmarts. You write about them that they say that they want to turn Vermont into, make it become one huge park. What do you base that claim on?
Well, a little hyperbole, perhaps, but or poetic license. But they, as you indicated, have resisted an awful lot of development projects in the state. And the theme of my book is the Vermont Way balances those objectives, which is preserving the natural beauty of our state, with providing opportunities for people to get a decent job and have a place to live and enjoy the quality of life that we want in our state. And I don't think that special interest law firms like CLF see that balance or seek it. We've got a stagnant population, as we've discussed. We've got a very high cost of living here. We've got to attract and retain more young working age families and create jobs that will be available to them. And that means we're going to have some growth. And I think there are forces at work to resist that. IBM is now back in the news, obviously, and it's been going through some really challenging times from a corporate standpoint. But when I was talking to them a decade or a dozen years ago, they made it very clear that the Circ Highway was essential. I remember one executive saying, "This isn't a nice to have. This is critical to the operation of our business." And I guess it's not going to happen.
So that road should have been built for IBM?
Well, not only for IBM, but for the growth in northwestern Vermont, which is the only part of our state now that is actually seeing some growth. The assumption was that it would be built, and if it weren't, then Route 2A, for example, through Williston would have been constructed differently with more lanes. But it's pretty tough to get around. I had a fellow who worked for me, Mark, who lived in Essex and commuted to Montpelier. He said it was 35 minutes to get to his office right down the interstate. And then he took a job in South Burlington, and he said, "It's 35 minutes to get to my job there, just a few miles away." I think that infrastructure is critical, and sadly, I guess it's not going to happen.
Can you draw a connection between No Circ Highway and IBM and their recent decision to sell their plant?
Well, a lot has been happening with the company on a global basis, so it's hard to tie it directly to where they are now in their corporate strategy. But we certainly would have been in a better position during the last decade or so if we had continued to make that commitment.
Mm-hmm. Back on Conservation Law Foundation, do they deserve any sort of credit for trying to be aggressive and get public officials to clean up Lake Champlain in that lawsuit?
Well, I don't think that was necessary because I was dedicated to cleaning it up, and I think the record's pretty clear on that with the Clean and Clear program, with my discussions with the folks at EPA, with my work with the Lake Champlain Basin Program. And if you look at the reports on lake quality between the early part of the last decade and the final one in 2010, you could see some modest incremental progress in water quality in some parts of the lake. This is a long process. Now, unfortunately, the following year, we had a couple of events that worked against it. But I don't think lawsuits are going to make any difference. They just distract the people who need to focus on cleaning up the lake. They divert resources that could be used on actual cleanup projects. No, I don't think lawsuits make any difference.
Howard Dean gave you some advice when you took office to not use email. Did you follow his advice on that?
I sure did.
Why?
Because some of his email was subpoenaed in a court case. It was a development project, I think, at Killington. And his advice to me was, you don't want to have something that's discoverable. I think there's some federal officials who probably wish they'd followed that advice more recently, too. It was tough. I had email when I was state treasurer, so I went cold turkey. But my staff had it. The troopers who were with me all the time had it. But I didn't, and I survived.
Is there a better way to do this?
Yeah, I think we've got to think through the whole question of transparency. And this is a topic of a topic in another book that just came out called City of Rivals by a fellow who works in Washington who's a friend of mine. And he said, we've gone overboard. And actually, when Fred Allen was Chief Justice of our state Supreme Court, he made this point in a decision. I wish I could quote it for you specifically. But they both said that public officials have to have the flexibility and opportunity to test ideas, to talk with their staffs and colleagues, and to throw out suggestions that may be totally wild and crazy and abandoned before policy is ultimately developed, without fear that every piece of paper, every scrap, every email that they've written will be a matter of public record. And I think that's right. Obviously, we want the sunlight of public scrutiny to shine on decision-making, but I think we've gone overboard.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free, 877-291-8255. I want to talk about health care for a moment here. You say that Obamacare and the expansion of Medicaid is going to basically sink us. Why?
Well, it's not going to matter in Vermont so much because we already had expanded, but a Democratic colleague of mine at the time said that was the mother of all unfunded mandates because there are a number of states in this country, Mark, mostly down south, that have Medicaid programs that have been very modest, to put it charitably, and this requires a huge additional expenditure of billions of dollars to bring them up to this new standard of 133-138% of the poverty level. And I realize the argument is that while the feds are paying 95 or so percent, but as I said at the time, 5% of the gazillion is still a whole lot of money. So at a time when a lot of states cut back on education, coming out of the Great Recession, to have this mandate on them, is going to put even further fiscal stress on a lot of those states. I don't like mandates, generally. I don't think they're successful. We have a auto insurance requirement, and we still have 10 or 15% of our drivers who don't carry it. Vermont, as you know, has, at least last time I checked, the second lowest uninsured rate in the country. That may be changing a little with expanded coverage. So, why do we throw the baby out with the bathwater when we've got just a few tens of thousands of folks who are uninsured? I think it was an overreaction. And the other concern I have that I express in the book is that the way it was handled when it was rammed through on a party line vote was a major contributing factor, I think, to the polarization and the grumpiness that we see in our national capital now. So, both in terms of substance and process, I think it was not handled well. And I also make the point that the president said it was his top domestic priority at a time when we're just coming out of the Great Recession. It would seem to me the top domestic priority would be getting everybody back to work. So I'm confused by all that.
Do you think you get enough credit for what you did in terms of the Blueprint for Health, some early healthcare reform efforts, or do you think they've been kind of overshadowed by this whole discussion about single payer and everything that happened since you left office?
I guess the answer is both in a way. In healthcare circles around the country, people laud the blueprint. I had a contact from an official at the Department of Health and Human Services just within the last month. Saying, oh gosh, we'd like to meet with you to talk about your efforts in Vermont and how successful they were. There are other states. Oregon is one that basically copied the blueprint law. I remember the governor at the time saying, I hope we remember to change the name of the state when we put the law through our legislature, and I assume we did. So I think there are a lot of people in the biz who understand that this was groundbreaking. It was the right thing to do at the right time. It's not flashy, but it's really making a difference. But you're right. Memories of the public are not too long in some cases, and now there's a lot more talk about this single-payer strategy. But I think the blueprint still stands strong.
You mentioned at one point, you talked about the toughest decisions that you made as governor, and you talked about there were difficult budget discussions that happened, and then you also mentioned that there were key appointees that you had to resign and that that was a difficult and tough choice. What was difficult about that for you?
Well, I, in some cases, asked people to leave a position in another job to take a role in my administration, and then to find that it didn't work out as well as I had hoped was tough for me from a personal standpoint because of the commitment I'd asked the individual to make. But I realized in the end, my responsibility, my oath of office is to the state and its people. And especially with the brevity of the terms, I just couldn't afford to have folks around who weren't pulling their weight, weren't fulfilling the job responsibilities as I saw them. So I did make some decisions about asking folks to move on, but they weren't as well publicized as some recent ones.
Mm-hmm. How did you change in 8 years? How did you grow? What did you learn?
Well, I got grayer. I asked Kate Gridley, the artist of my portrait, to color in some of the gray, to which she replied adamantly, "I paint what I see." So, obviously, that experience is one that was critical in my life. I often say, Mark, that I was in the legislature in my 20s, I was Secretary of State in my 30s, I was Treasurer in my 40s, and held the governorship in my 50s. So it was an important part of my career and growth as an individual. I guess I learned a lot more about working in that kind of executive environment. I'd been a department head before and provided leadership to dozens of people, but not thousands, in terms of the operation of government. I learned about making tough decisions when we had to downsize, including some layoffs after the Great Recession, and about developing strategy and doing my best to implement it. I learned an awful lot more about Vermont, although I'd been around the state quite a lot anyway. When I was Secretary of State, I visited every town clerk's office at least once during the time I was in office, but I got to learn a lot more nooks and crannies, and it was kind of interesting a few times when people, including my wife, who's a native Vermonter, would be surprised that I was more familiar with the landscape than they. So I learned a lot about myself and my abilities, enhanced my own self-confidence. I learned a lot about Vermont, and in the end, felt good and feel good about my stewardship in office.
Okay, enhanced self-confidence. I just heard there. What else? How did you change as a person? That was in 8 significant years of your life at a significant period. I'm at about that same age too. So how did you change?
I guess I also. I'm not sure what more to say. I also learned about expectations and. I think I knew it wasn't a throne and that it's part of a representative democracy where I have to work with folks who have different points of view, and did my best to do that. I think although we had some tough battles that I described, we still passed a budget every year, did the people's business, contrasted from what's going on in Washington, clearly. So I guess I understood that I couldn't accomplish everything I would like, but was willing to understand that, accept that, and do as much as I could.
Mm-hmm. You didn't write about that very much, though. How come?
I think the book is long enough. I had a lot to say. Maybe you can edit the sequel.
We'll see. Okay. All right. I mean, I'm not trying to be Oprah with you here, but I really wanted to learn more about you.
Well, I think this goes back to a question you asked earlier. It's not easy, it's not natural, it's not comfortable to write about oneself. So I I talked a lot about the experiences I had, offered some reflections and perspectives, but I'm sorry there aren't as many as you would like to have read.
What's it like in terms of being post-governor? What's the difficult part about being in this period of your life?
Well, it is an adjustment. There's an old saying that on the day after his successor's inauguration, the governor woke up, got dressed, went out to the car, got in it, and it didn't move. So it is a logistical adjustment in that sense. One day you have the trappings of office such as they are in our small state and a lot of staff at your disposal, and then you don't. Doing errands for my new superior and commanding officer at home, finding a parking spot on campus that I didn't have to worry about before, making my own airplane reservations and other things. There's certainly a logistical change, but I'm okay with it. I think of President Bush, who a lot of people say did very well in adjusting to private life. And that's contrasted with Lyndon Johnson, who, according to Robert Caro's biography, had a tough time. he was leader of the free world one day and had just a few farmhands the next day to boss around. So I think I've been successful because I'm comfortable with the decision I made. Obviously don't agree with everything that's going on in Montpelier now, but I could have stayed. So I don't have license to complain, and I'm doing just fine.
Caro, by the way, can write a gripping 900-page book that's like a page-turner. You don't miss the juice?
No, because whenever I get my adrenaline rises a little and I think about how I would do something differently, I take a deep breath and I think it was the right thing to do to move on. I had my opportunity. There's always some challenge unmet, some goal unachieved, something more to do, but at some point you have to pass the baton, and as I suggested earlier, it's important to do it before you have to, and I'm very comfortable with the time that I chose.
One story I did not know until I read your book was how close the Phish concert came to getting canceled.
Yeah, yeah, that was a mess, as you recall, meteorologically.
I mean, wow, it was close. You would have had you knew that would have been a storm, shall we say.
Well, that's the essence of leadership, making those tough decisions when your staff are telling you to go one way and your gut tells you to go another.
So tell people what happened.
Well, it was a terrible storm. It was in Coventry, 06? I can't remember exactly which year now. And they were expecting a huge crowd. It's a very remote location, not very convenient off the interstate or even Route 5. And we had a lot of meetings in advance with the state police, the local authorities. The organizers or the concert promoters are used to putting on these events, so they have a lot of experience. But what we didn't anticipate was torrential rains that turned the venue, especially for parking, into a mud bog. And the state police and other authorities at the site felt that it was too dangerous. They couldn't even get cars into the parking area. And they thought the best thing to do, which they had the authority to do, contractually and legally, was to pull the plug and cancel the concert. And the commissioner called me very early in the morning, pre-dawn, as I recall, and so I was half awake. And I said, this is the Phish concert.
This is not good.
And it was a mess. We had problems where folks abandoned their cars on I-91. We got some National Guard helicopters with searchlights to brighten the area after the concert when people were making their way back to their cars. There was a lot of entrepreneurism as local farmers hauled people into the parking lot. They were towing people into the muddy parking lot and charging for it.
As you said, imagine what it's going to take to tow them back out.
Which they ultimately did.
Now, I think this is not a criticism or a negative. I don't think people would describe you as being the most hip guy on the planet, but you knew that Phish concert was a big deal.
I did. And I'm glad we went ahead with it. A lot of people, of course, chose not to come who were planning to because the weather was so bad, which helped. But we still, I just realized that we couldn't pull the plug.
Uh-huh. What do you want to accomplish with the rest of your life?
Well, I don't know if I have an answer to that, Mark. I'm doing some teaching at Middlebury.
You don't think about that?
No,
what do you
want
to do for the rest of your life?
No, I want to be...
What do you want to get done before you stage left here off of this planet?
Well, I've got an awful lot of time left. I mean, I'm not as old as Joel Nagemann or folks like that. I mean, I've got a lot of time left. So I'm enjoying teaching, doing some work with a couple of companies, working with a group in Washington called the Bipartisan Policy Center that's trying to bring some civility and rational discourse to that strange place on our planet. I want to spend more time with my grandkids, but I don't know what the future holds. And as I suggest in the book, in many points along the way, I made decisions pretty much on the fly, not knowing what I was going to run for until very close to the filing deadline. So the answer I generally give is I just don't know what I want to do when I grow up.
Mm-hmm. At the end of this book, what do you think people are going to have learned about you?
I think they'll see my perspective on the last three or four decades of the Vermont political experience. They'll learn about my priorities, my accomplishments. I hope they'll be amused by some of the stories I tell along the way. I think they'll see how a Republican led in a deep blue state.
You think you answered that question?
Well, I think so. As we discussed it earlier in a couple of different ways. My interaction with the people of Vermont and my efforts at balancing the various interests of Vermont. We don't have many centrists in Washington anymore, and I think that's what the nation cries out for. And I think I fit that mold.
You'll take a call from East Montpelier. We'll let you go. Bob, good morning.
Yeah. Wasn't sure if I was going to make it or not at the time. But I was just curious. Do you think if you had still been governor, Vermont Yankee would still be open right now?
That's a good question.
Well, it's hard to know because ultimately they made a decision based on economics and a small plant and it's how it fits into the larger corporate structure. So it's hard to know. Just like IBM, there are decisions that are made by the entity itself, not just government, that make a difference. But I certainly would have continued to do my best to support the plant. It was the cheapest electricity we had. When I assumed office, we had the highest rates in New England. When I left office, we had the lowest rates. They're starting to creep up again. I think we have to not be ideological, but to look at the cost of living here, and that was a major factor in moderating our rates. Having said that, as I indicate in the book, and I indicated at the time, energy is a tough company to love. Some miscues along the way that were not helping their case. So hard to know if it would be open, but the state's position certainly would have been different.
You going to be anywhere other than Bridgeside Books in a couple of minutes here? Any other events coming up that you want to talk about?
Not in the immediate future, but there'll be other visits to bookstores all across Vermont in the coming months.
Okay. One other question I had for you. Just
one more.
One more.
Yeah.
And I didn't take it personally, and you can give me a funny Jim Douglas answer, you can give me a real answer here. You talk here at one point, you say an interview program, you're talking about talk radio, is rarely an opportunity for reflection and learning, but rather a call to arms to carry the banner of an ideological cause. The edginess gets the juices flowing in other ways. Callers to talk shows are often provocative. You really think that an interview program is a rare opportunity for reflection and learning? I tried here this morning.
I think you did a great job. But many times, as I'm sure you know, and you've experienced it as well, during a political campaign, each campaign does its best to get its callers to call in. Some of the callers are obviously reading the questions that are prepared by their candidates' staff. That's what I was getting at.
Once in a while, we've had people call from Brattleboro before the show even starts, and it's kind of obvious then. But, I mean, for the most part, this program, and I think most programs in Vermont, you know, maybe not You're disagreeing with me.
I think it varies. But you always enlighten your listeners, Mark, and I appreciate that.
All right. Well, that's, see, I knew that that's probably the answer I would get. Thank you for coming in. Any future plans we should know about here? Anything else you want to add before we let you go?
No, thevermontway.us is the website that folks can log on to and buy the book.
I do have one other question. The title. There's some people that I've mentioned this to. They say, really, the Vermont way? As though, as if you don't agree with Jim Douglas, it's not the Vermont way. So what's the deal with the title?
Well, as I point out in a chapter by that same name, that's a phrase that I used in my 04 State of the State message to talk about the issues we've mentioned this morning, to try to find that balance between economic growth and environmental protection. And I said there are some folks who are extremists on both sides, and we have to find a third way, a Vermont way, to accommodate those mutually important interests. So I talk about that, and that's the phrase that was the genesis of the title.
Anything you want to mention I didn't ask?
No, not at 5
okay,
after
I'll
10.
Let you go. Right. All right. Thanks for coming in. Former Vermont Governor Jim Douglas, the author of The Vermont Way. He'll be heading right down the road here to Bridgeside here in just a moment. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier. Quick break. We'll check in with Bob Nay coming up next.
Hey there, car and truck buyers. Pull